Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Monday, March 25th, 2024. Let the record reflect the time is 3:17 p.m. Today we have present Representative Sadler, Representative Prox, Representative Wright, Representative Carrick, Representative Fields, Vice Chair Ruffridge, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff that will be assisting us today are Kevin Allen with House Records and Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO, Clark Bickford, my staff and committee aide to House Labor and Commerce. We have a full agenda today in committee. We're going to try to make up for some lost time. Today we have four hearings on the following bills: House Bill 218, Firefighters Worker Comp Requirements; House Bill 313, Public Utility Regulatory Cost Charge; House Bill 324, Insurance Data Security; House Bill 55, Extend Workforce Investment Board Allocations. We'll finish the meeting with public testimony on House Bill 226, Pharmacist Benefit Managers. Starting with House Bill 218, Workers' Comp Firefighter Worker Comp Requirements from Representative Sadler's office. We heard this bill set an amendment deadline and received two or three. It's debatable. And we will address those now. Representative Fields.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll move Amendment 1.
Object.
Okay, there's objection. Representative Fields.
Thank you. Amendment 1 lengthens the period of time post-employment that firefighters can be covered by workers' compensation from 5 years to 7 years. It maintains the current system of covering a firefighter for a period of time post-employment, but pushes the timeline out a little farther, from 3 months per year of employment to 6 months per year of employment. This is after hearing the bill, and like I said, I definitely appreciate the bill sponsor bringing this forward because I think it addresses some concerns that I had had in a previous session. I asked Alaska Professional Firefighters Association for their take on the bill and if there were any potential refinements that we should consider, and this is based on feedback from firefighters. So happy to answer any questions, and also I don't know if Justin Mack with the APFA is online to answer questions if members have questions kind of from the perspective of a firefighter.
Does not appear we have anyone online. Any other comments on Amendment Number 1? Representative Prox.
Thank you. My concern is we have not heard from the workers' compensation insurance providers as to whether they can handle the increased risk at the premiums to be charged. And I had some experience in this field quite a few years ago, and Alaska has a small market, and the company, well, the local statewide company that's providing workers' compensation coverage might not be able to figure out the actuarial risk, or they might decide that it is so high that they discontinue offering policies to fire insurance provide our fire companies. And if they do, then the companies get kicked into the assigned risk pool, I think it's called, and the premiums go way up. So we would want to know how that is going to affect the premiums before deciding whether this is something that will actually benefit the firefighters. They might price themselves out of the market.
Mr. Chairman, is a representative of Alaska National online?
We have nobody online right now. Okay. For this bill. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not sure how I want to proceed. A question, a motion has been made on one topic or one amendment to one topic, and a question raised on a different.
Yeah.
With your indulgence, there were a couple of questions that were hanging out from the last meeting. If I could have the opportunity to answer those before we could engage on the actual amendment language, might be helpful.
Do you want me to withdraw the amendment for now? Or?
Why don't you withdraw the amendment? We can address those questions, and then we can go back into the amendment process.
Thank you. I'll withdraw Amendment Number 1 for the moment.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that, and I understand the workload we have. I'll try to be brief. Three questions specifically were raised during the initial hearing on the bill. I've had my staff distribute to committee members answers to those, but I'd like to read them in the record briefly. The first question asked was, what was the intention of the bill, HB 218? of distinguishing between hiring and certification. And the answer we came back was that there are some differences between when someone becomes hired and becomes certified. It's possible to be hired as a firefighter and work as a firefighter, you know, pulling hoses, driving trucks, directing traffic, opening up fire hydrants, et cetera. But it requires the certification from the Alaska Fire Standards Council as a firefighter one before you can actually wear the Scott pack and go into a burning building. So in working with the firefighters, with this with the Fire Chiefs Association, we sought to cover both of those ends, because sometimes someone will get hired and it can take months, even years possibly, before they get that certification. So the goal was to have those exams at both areas. So that's the first question. It does appear that there's amendments later on in the process here that will obviate that need for that distinguishment. The second question raised in the hearing was kind of related, the time between hiring and being certified. And the answer to that is it is not uncommon for firefighters to be hired at a department and then only become certified months or perhaps years later. Third question raised by Representative Prox to my right here was the question about the effect on the risk pool of this coverage. And I will remind members that, I'll say this question was raised back in 2022 when then Senator Holland added breast cancer to the list of presumed diseases for which service as a firefighter was a presumed cause. The Division of Insurance at that time and the Division of Workers' Compensation both testified that there was no indication that the bill would increase the risk or the cost. And I have it from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development that they concur. Further, we did consult with the NCCI, the National Council of Compensation Insurers, and they said that any change in the cost or risk would be incalculable due to how little provision this provision would ever be used. So the question, was this going to expose the departments to huge risk? The answer is, don't think so. I hope that answers those questions, and would be glad to answer any follow-up if necessary.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. I guess Representative Fields.
I'll move Amendment 1.
Okay.
And no objection.
There is objection. Representative Fields, I guess you spoke already, so Representative Sadler.
Thank you. If I may speak to the objection, it's not really an objection. It's a a little bit of perspective, I guess. The second part of the, starting on page 1, line 5 of the amendment, the extension of the how long the presumption lasts past a firefighter's retirement. Current statute is 60 months or 5 years. The proposed amendment would extend that to 7 years or 84 months. I don't have a problem with that. We have talked with the director of the Workers' Compensation Division and indicated he would support this as well. The first part of the amendment, which is line 1 through 14, also on page 1, is accomplished in Amendment 2. Now, Representative Fields, through the chair, I cannot presume that you have to trust what's going to happen with Amendment 2, but it is my intention to look favorably upon that first section of Amendment 2. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would offer conceptual Amendment 1 to Amendment 1, and that would be to delete lines 1 through 4.
Okay. Is there objection? There's objection. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair, Representative Sadler. I think amendment number 1, the underlying amendment, affects page 2, line 9. Amendment number 2, which we have not offered yet, would affect page 2, line 14. I do think that they are different.
Oh. You are correct. To the chair, you are correct, Mr. Representative Ruffridge. I made an assumption here. I think with the effect of, let's see, line 2. So I think the first part of Amendment 1 offered by Representative Fields increases by 100% the factor. So instead of 3 months for each year of service, it would be 6 months for every year of service, which would be a doubling of the extent of the time frame beyond which a retired firefighter could enjoy this presumption. I had not made that calculation, so with a couple quick things. Have a brief at ease, did a little bit of math.
Brief at ease. Representative Fields, I suppose.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In an attempt to answer the question, by going from 3 to 6 months per year of service, I believe that firefighters would continue to accrue additional benefits until with the adoption, prospect of adoption of Amendment 2, which would set it at 84 months, would be 14 years of service, as opposed to 20, which is, I believe, the status quo.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. So just so I'm clear, we are working still on conceptual Amendment 1 to Amendment 1, which would delete the language altering 3 months of service, 3 months of accrued possible disability for every year of requisite service. The proposed amendment, underlying amendment, would say to move it to 6 months, as well as increase the total number of calendar months following the last date of employment to 84. So I think there's a cap problem here, or a cap solution. So in the current language of statute right now, an individual has to work for 20 years to be capped out at 60 calendar months. I think Representative Field's underlying amendment, as well as, just the underlying amendment would say that an individual has to work for 14 years to cap out at the 84 months. Now, if we delete the language that changes 6 to 3, but keep the 84, an individual would have to work for well over 30 years to cap out. So I think that I would not be in support of amendment number conceptual amendment 1 to amendment 1, because it would extend that time for way too long.
Representative Ruffridge, I think that'd be slightly under 30 years, but
Mr. Chairman, it's actually 28, but Representative Ruffridge was very close.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else? Representative Sadler?
Mr. Chair, I had misread the bill and the effect of Amendment 1. I hadn't seen it until just recently myself. So I think that extending the period up to as much as 30 years for this provision is too much. I would be okay with the second section, which is, you know, page 2, line 10, at least 60 at 84. So I guess I would... my preference, I guess, I will withdraw conceptual amendment 1 and begin offering it. So it would be my preference to not accept amendment 1 and then to make modification to the next amendment to accomplish the delete 16 at 84 provision.
Okay, there is objection, please. And conceptual amendment number 1 has been withdrawn, so we are on amendment number 1. Please call the roll on amendment number 1.
Representative Fronts.
No.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Wright.
No.
Representative Carrick.
Yes.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Chair Sumner.
No. And so with 3 yeas and 4 nays, amendment number 1 has failed to pass. Amendment number 2, Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. I move Amendment 2.
Is there objection?
Object.
Okay. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Amendment number 2 does a few different items. First, on page 2, line 14 of the bill, where the proposed bill changes the current statute of the firefighter who has a disease described in the section above, develops or manifests itself after the firefighter has served in the state for, currently reads, 7 years. The bill proposes to change that to 3. This amendment would reduce it actually just by 1 year to 6 instead of 7. The rationale behind that is there is a significant, sometimes, period of time for some of these diseases to manifest themselves. 3 years seems to be a relatively short window, so I think 7 might be a little too long. 6 seems like a bit more of a appropriate number. On page 2, lines 15 through 25, this is really in the spirit of trying to clean up what was difficult, I guess, for me to understand in the bill, but deleting all the material there in lines 15 through 25 and then inserting a new section That actually gets rid of the language that Representative Sadler had talked about before about certification as a firefighter, and changes that just simply to underwent a qualifying medical examination upon first employment as a firefighter that did not show evidence of the disease. The bill actually proposes that once every 5 years that firefighter undergo an examination, which does seem, you know, the goal here, I think, is to ensure that some of these really horrible diseases are not creeping up without notice. A lot of these are easier treated upon early diagnosis. And so I think every 5 years is a bit of a big window, and I understand there's a cost factor to that, but extending that to instead once every 2 years instead of an annual medical exam during each of the first 6 years of employment matches up with the language that we inserted in page 2, line 14. And then finally, on page 2, line 30, following the word cancer, it was going to add in a whole new section, which is number 4, which reads the requirements of 3A, which is what we just talked about, apply only if the firefighter's employer make the applicable qualifying medical examination available to the firefighter. This may be slightly a debatable topic as to whether or not this should be made available by the employer, given the fact that many of our institutions are volunteer in nature. However, these qualifying medical examinations are very expensive and probably should be a part of the employment process. And if we reduce it to every 2 years, I think it might fit a little easier into a budget than every year. But those are the thoughts behind Amendment Number 2.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also divided this amendment into three constituent parts. You can pretty clearly see page 2, page 2, page 2. So I will say that part 1, I can certainly accept that because I think it accomplishes the bill's general goal to lower the onus of obtaining workers' comp insurance for firefighter cancers. Likewise, section 2, although it's not the exact schedule I had originally presumed and worked with the fire chiefs to say, I think it still advances the overall goal of the bill. However, section 3 of the amendment, number 2, I do take some exception to. It conditions the periodic medical exam required on whether or not the employer pays for it. And if the employer does not pay for the exam, then the periodic exam requirement goes away, does not apply. And I'm concerned this means that a person who got hired as a firefighter department who may have had cancer before being hired, there will be no requirement, if the department doesn't pay for it, there will be no requirement to establish that baseline. And now because this would expose departments to the risk of workers' comp claims in the future, resulting from a disability that was from a cancer that could have been detected had they had been exam paid for by the department but did not. Again, the underlying statute provides a path for firefighters to get the presumption of disability coverage for illnesses resulting from their work. And my bill seems to do no more than to modify that path by letting the presumption apply to firefighters earlier and reducing the financial burden. My concern is that this third section of Amendment 2 contravenes the purpose of both the underlying statute and the bill by potentially increasing cost to fire departments and opening up the presumption of coverage for firefighters whose disability did not result from an illness. So I would oppose this third section. I'm okay with the first two, but I think the third section it goes the wrong direction.
Okay. Representative Fields.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to ask both the amendment sponsor and the bill sponsor if they want me to offer a conceptual amendment to add lines 5 and 7 of Amendment 1 into this amendment, which I think Representative Sadler had suggested earlier. Happy to do it if the members want to do that. Happy not to if they don't.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pardon me. I guess at this point, through the Chair, Representative Fields, that would not be my preference. I'm going to make an amendment to this amendment to eliminate that third section, but I fear getting too far down a rabbit trail and confusing things and just...
No problem.
So, thank you. Accordingly?
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move... I'm going to take the third amendment you have in your stack, which is .B.3. While it is labeled Amendment 3, I would like to deem it Amendment 1 to Amendment 2. And then move Amendment 1 to Amendment 2, which would have the effect of deleting the lines 16 through 20 on Amendment 2.
Okay. There's objection. Representative Seiler, did you want to speak to your amendment to the amendment?
Thank you. No, I think just to wrap up, I guess, I think that the first two sections of Amendment 2 are fine and comport with the intent of the underlying statute and my bill. But I think that Section 3 does not. And so I think I'd like to excise the not so good and retain the good.
Okay. Representative Breppridge, did you have a comment?
No comment.
No. Representative Carrick?
Thank you to the sponsor of the amendment. Are there currently employers who do not offer applicable qualifying medical examinations? And so is the hope that with the rest of the language adoption in Amendment 2, we would be establishing requirements that we're capable of employers to meet? I guess, can you talk a little bit more about your intent in this section?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, this language really is variable throughout the state. From my, work on trying to understand how this process happens throughout multiple types of firefighting apparatuses and groups across the state, certainly volunteer firefighting groups. Struggle in many ways to offer some of these expensive medical examinations. However, the bill in its initial iteration and in some of the testimony we heard, moving that time frame by in the initial thought was up to 5 years for a medical exam really would help offset the cost. It can be about up to $1,800 to do one of the qualifying medical exams from the research that I did. And certainly we can hear testimony either to the contrary or, supporting that. But it is a significant cost. That being said, I know that there are many employers that do make these qualifying medical examinations available. And I think it is probably a standard that should be upheld is offering them, but I know that it can be a barrier or a cost barrier to some. I don't know. I hope that answered your question.
Okay, there's objection. Please call the roll. Representative Seiler, did you have a comment? Sorry.
If I may, kind of wrap up. What the third part of Amendment 2 does, which I propose with my amendment to delete, what it does is it conditions that period. It says it conditions the periodic medical exam on whether or not the department pays the cost of the exam. I don't think there's any requirement for an individual to get those examinations. And if they don't have the exams, they may have a harder time proving that any cancer they develop later was caused by their service as a firefighter. So I believe it's a disincentive for departments to provide those periodic medical exams. So as such, I think it's kind of contradictory to the intent of the bill and the law.
Okay. There is objection. Please call the roll on Amendment Number 1 to Amendment Number 2.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Representative Prox.
No.
Representative Ruffridge.
No.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Wright.
Yes.
Representative Carrick.
Yes.
Representative Fields.
No.
Chair Sumner.
Yes. And so with 4 yays and 3 nays, Amendment Number 1 to Amendment Number 2 has passed. We have before us Amendment Number 2 as amended. Is there anything further? Okay, there, I believe, is still objection, so please call the roll on Amendment Number 2.
Representative Carrick.
Yes.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Representative Frogs.
Yes.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Wright.
Yes.
Chair Sumner.
Yes. So with seven yeas and zero nays, amendment number two has passed. Seeing no other amendments to the bill, Vice Chair Ruffridge, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Chair Sumner. I would move House Bill number 218, version Bravo, also referred to as 33-LS0709-B, be advanced from committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Okay, without objection, House Bill 218 shall be reported from committee. Next on the agenda is House Bill 313, Public Utility Regulatory Cost Charge, a bill by request of the governor. Today with us today is Becky Alvey, Section Manager, RCA, and Naomi Johnson, Administrative Operation Manager of the RCA. Please put your name on the record and begin.
Good afternoon. My name is Becky Alvey. I'm the Advisory Section Manager at the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
Thank you. For the record, Naomi Johnston, Admin Operations Manager with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
For our presentation, we're just going to give you an overview of the RCA and discuss House Bill 313. The RCA performs quasi-judicial and quasi-legislative functions. It's comprised of four main sections, a commission section with five commissioners who are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the legislature, a consumer protection staff, a number of support sections, an administrative law section consisting of hearing examiners and paralegals, and the advisory section, which I oversee, comprised of tariff, engineering, and financial analysts, and communication specialists, and then our last section is utility master analysts. The commission is created by statute, AS 4204, and is required by statute to regulate public utilities and pipeline carriers. The commission is also required by statute, AS 4245, to determine the per kilowatt hour support for eligible customers of electric utilities under the PCE program. The RCA's core services include certificating applicants that are fit, willing, and able to provide service, reviewing tariff filings made by utilities and pipeline carriers, ensuring rates are just and reasonable, investigating complaints, and calculating PCE and setting the PCE base rate, or also known as the PCE floor. One main function of the RCA is tariff review, and this staff analyzes the filings to determine if the rates are just and reasonable, if the tariff provisions are reasonable and supported. This slide kind of goes through our general process of the tariff filing. An entity would make a tariff filing, the commission would issue a public notice of the proposed change, and then we have a review period for utilities. It's 45 days. Prior to the end of that review period, the commission would approve, reject, or suspend the filing. If the commission took no action, then the filing takes effect by force of law, which is something that we generally try to avoid. If the tariff is suspended into a docket for further investigation, we would assign a commission panel and an administrative law judge. Hearings would be held as applicable, and then a final order would be issued with the commission's decision. And I've listed kind of a couple of our common timelines. 450 days for changes for like rate cases, so changes to a revenue requirement, or 270 days if it's not a change to the revenue requirement. Another important role of the RCA is the PCE program. The RCA establishes the PCE amounts for participating utilities, which is 11 regulated electric utilities and 78 non-regulated utilities that participate in the program, which impacts more than 150 communities. We set the PCE base rate, or as I said, the floor, which is the weighted average cost of the retail rate in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, which is subject to the statutory ceiling, which is $1, and that's set out in AS 4245. And the PCE program is administered also by the Alaska Energy Authority. So kind of getting into some of the little nitty-gritty. So the funding of the RCA, since 1993, the Regulatory Cost Charge Program, or the RCC, has been the main source of funding for the RCA. Beginning in 2005, the RCC program also became the main source of funding for the Department of Law's Regulatory Affairs and Public Advocacy section, or also known as RAPA. Majority of the RCA's budget is directly funded by the RCC. The RCA does receive funds from AEA through an RSA to offset costs of administering the PCE program, but there no other general fund support is received for our operations. Regulated utilities, telecommunications utilities, and pipeline carriers pay the RCC, which they are permitted to recover from their customers and shippers. After the RCA's annual budget is passed by the legislature, the RCA is required to notify the public and the regulated entities of the annual RCC amount. The RCA is calculated on an annual basis to be effective July 1 of each year and based on the formula set out in regulation. The RCC amount is established by commission order, and once that it's established by that order, the RCA issues tariff sheets to the regulated entities reflecting the new RCC amount. The statutes provide that the amount that the RCA expects to collect through the RCC from all regulated entities, utilities, certificated telecom utilities, and pipeline carriers may not exceed the sum of the following percentages of the total adjusted gross revenue for all regulated utilities, telecom utilities, and pipeline carriers. This percentage is no more than 0.7% to fund operations of the RCA and no more than 0.17% to fund operations of RAPA. These caps were enacted with Senate Bill 392 and signed into law June 25th, 2004. The statutory cap sets the ceiling of what the RCA may collect. As previously stated, the legislature approves the RCA's operating budget, and the RCC formula calculates how much of the operating budget is needed to be collected from the RCCs. The RCA is unable to collect more in RCCs than what is set in the statutory cap. The proposed changes to the statutory cap from House Bill 313 would increase the percentages from 0.7% to 0.98% to fund operations of the RCA, and from 0.17% to 0.22% to fund the operations of RAPA. The Alaska Energy Security Task Force report listed a number of high priority actions that it felt would help advance the overall actions or outcomes identified in its report. One of the actions included was providing support for the RCA sufficient to improve the RCA's ability to respond timely and appropriately to the complex energy production, generation, and transmission challenges in Alaska. The task force found that within all expected scenarios, the RCA must be provided sufficient budgetary support to be able to attract and retain highly skilled technical, legal, and administrative staff necessary to help adjudicate the complex and rapidly increasing pace of decisions that are necessary to support Alaska's continued access to affordable, reliable, and resilient energy. This next slide discusses several of the impacts. As shown on the slide, the following slides, which I will let Naomi discuss. The projected budgets for the RCA and RAPA will soon exceed the statutory cap. Without an increase to the statutory cap, the RCA and RAPA may not be able to collect the amount needed through the RCC to fund operations. On the right side of this slide, we tried to kind of show a potential impact to ratepayers. Currently, the RCC for electric utilities is $0.001028. Dollars per kilowatt hour, which equates out to about 67 cents on a 650 kilowatt hour customer bill. If we apply the proposed change to the statutory cap to the current RCC, it would increase the impact on a customer by about 27 cents, which comes out to 94 cents per kilowatt hour. I'm going to turn kind of the discussion of some of these charts over to our Administrative Operations Manager, Naomi.
For the record, Naomi Johnston, Admin Operations Manager with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. The charts that you see here present a projected 10-year forecast with our current statutory cap and the requested statutory cap increase. In both charts, the current statutory cap is shown in gray, the gray background. The fluctuations are based on a five-year historical pattern, just to kind of show how that statutory cap can increase or decrease depending on the gross operating revenues of the utilities in the prior calendar year. The blue line represents the requested statutory cap with the same fluctuations as the current. The chart on the left for the RCA, the green column represents the RCA's authorized budget, and that is projected using an average of the prior 5 years, an increase of roughly 2.11%. And the orange column represents the revenue the RCA needs to collect from RCCs. This amount can vary depending on how much carry forward we are estimating from the prior year, if there are any other sources of revenue, and if there's any uncollectible RCCs from the prior year. So we're not always collecting the full amount in RCCs that is outlined in the RCA's budget. The chart on the right shows RAPA's projected operating budget, shown together with the current statutory cap and the proposed statutory cap. Just to make note that RAPA actually began to exceed their statutory cap in FY23 by about $8,700.
And with that, we're happy to take any questions.
Representative Fields.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the opportunity to learn more. My question is, if the committee went in a different direction and, say, deregulated approval of projects, say, under 200 megawatts, how much money would that save for the RCA, and would that obviate the need for an increase in fees? Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I guess for 200 megawatts, so just electric, if all electric was deregulated, I don't know off the top of my head how that would impact the RCA and our operations, and whether or not we'd need additional, or if we'd need the statutory cap, but I can find out.
If I could just follow up through the chair. So I know that GVA and Chugach are pursuing three projects. I believe they're about 120, 130 megawatts each. They're about the cost of current gas. They're much less expensive than imported gas. To me, it's a no-brainer. They should be pursuing them, and I just want to get a sense if those projects were essentially deregulated, since co-ops do have elected boards and voters have a high degree of accountability, how much money would that save? And I appreciate learning more and follow-up.
Interesting. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair, I actually just have a few questions that I've been jotting down over here. So I guess this piece of legislation would increase the number of fees to go to operations of the RCA. Is that how I'm to take the bill?
Too many answers.
Just to be super clear.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge. So this is just requesting to increase the ceiling that the RCA can collect. So we currently are projected, and there's a lot of variables, a lot depends. It could be sooner, could be later. But if we're on the same trajectory, we're looking to exceed the current cap in FY26. This bill simply just increases the ceiling so that we're able to collect what we need in order to fund our operations.
Okay, thank you. So I guess on the funding of operations, do you guys have vacant positions currently inside the RCA?
Yes, we do.
How many of those do you have?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, last I calculated, I want to say it was we're about 33% vacancy rate. So about, I want to say 19.
Okay. And sorry, am I allowed to ask a few questions, Mr. Right. Chair? Thank you. So I've had a number of, I guess, questions about some of the operations, particularly when it comes to PCE. And I guess, are you aware of a resolution that was passed in October from AFN? It was Resolution 2318?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, I am not aware.
Okay. Well, the resolution called for the state of Alaska to investigate the operations of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska that causes rural residents undue financial hardships that affect their ability to thrive. That was almost word for word what AFN passed as a resolution. Why do you think they would have passed a resolution like that? I'm just concerned because even though it's a small little increase, we already have individuals in our state who are passing resolutions saying we pay too much.
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge. So I was aware of, just for the record, I was aware of the resolution. There is a number of, so there's multiple factors in a customer bill. One of them is the RCC. If the utility chooses to pass that on to their customer, the utility can elect not to, but most of them do pass the RCC on to their customer and then through us. Some of the items that are happening are outside of the RCC or just increases in costs as well. I think I lost the rest of the question.
I guess my question really is, one, were you aware of the resolution? And two, I guess, really, what are you doing about the resolution? It feels odd that we're asking to raise sort of a statutory cap and then knowing that realistically, you know, people specifically in rural Alaska are crying help. And I know in people in my own district are saying, holy smokes, like things have gotten a little expensive. And I know the plan here would be potentially that more increased costs are passed on to consumers. And, you know, I'm wondering with the capacity of either vacant positions, other sorts of things, is RCA really, you know, in need of that extra money when everyone else is hurting? That's really the tenor of my question.
Okay. Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, sort of on the same lines, if you received more money to do your work, you could probably hire a few more people. Is it possible that would reduce the timeline for your docket processing? I forget, you said it was, I gathered it was almost a year.
Through the chair, Representative Prox, our timelines are set out in statute. We do try to get things done in as efficient a manner as possible. So some of our timelines, if the commission investigates the filing and suspends it for further investigation, those are the longer timelines. If we can handle the filings within just the usual tariff process, then it's about 45 days. Okay. The items that are getting suspended frequently are some of the revenue requirements or the rate cases, which we have a number before us, and some of those can be rather complex and do need the timeline. Some of the less complex potentially could be resolved earlier than that. It depends a little bit on the complexity and what the issues in the case are.
Okay. Thank you.
My understanding is the RCA regulates residential trash pickup. Is that correct?
Chair Sumner, we regulate trash, residential and commercial, except commercial in Anchorage, the Fairbanks borough, the Mat-Su, and the Kenai are not rate regulated, but they still are required to make filings with us.
Are you sure that you don't regulate residential trash pickup in the Mat-Su?
For clarification, Chair Sumner, we do regulate residential trash pickup across the state.
How much time do you think you spend on that?
Chair Sumner, I'm not sure on the quite the number of hours. I would have to look to see. We've handled, we account for trash as a whole and not just commercial or residential when we are keeping track of our time. But there is an amount of time that we spend on trash.
Do you know how many regulated trash haulers you're regulating in the Mat-Su right now? I would guess it's at least four.
I believe, Chair Sumner, I believe it's about four. It might be a couple more than that.
Representative Carrick?
Thank you, through the chair. Recognizing that it's probably a fairly non-standard number, do you have a sense of the average percentage of a utility's cost the RCC represents? Or even just a raw dollar number? Or what does the average RCC cost to a utility?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, it would depend on the sales of the utility because it is the number of kilowatt hours that they sell times the rate. And I would have to look to see if we had an average of how many kilowatt hours. So it's going to vary between the smaller utilities and, say, like Chugach, which is kind of on the top end. Probably a couple, up to a couple $1,000.
Okay, I think through the chair, in kind of following up on Representative Ruffridge's earlier comment, I think that would be valuable information for the committee to have.
Yeah. Representative Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. So when we think about the cost of regulation, it's not just the cost of the RCA, but it's the staff time and the attorney time of electric utilities that have to put forward an application. I'm thinking, you know, we have this gas crisis. Chugach Electric had previously put in a community solar application that was denied. They went back and did it. It was approved. As we look at the imperative to diversify generation, I wonder if we can cut costs on the utility side. And in that vein, I was curious, have you estimated how much it costs our electric utilities to go through the process to permit new generation? Because I think if we're looking at a concept like I introduced of deregulating for some of these facilities designed to diversify generation, we should quantify not just the savings in terms of reduction in RCA costs, but the potential savings and reduction of utility admin costs that are necessary to go through the RCA process. Thank you.
Chair Sumner, or through the chair, excuse me, to Representative Fields, for the projects, typically for the new projects, we are not seeing, they're not coming in for project pre-approval, although that potentially would, or that will change with the large project pre-approval statutes that currently operate under the Electric Reliability Organization, but we have not in the past had a utility come in to see, to pretty much get pre-approval for whether or not they could build a project. So there would, when we would see the cost for that project, it would be when they're filing like their depreciation rates or filing their rate case.
I could just ask a follow-up. Maybe it might help me, and I will ask Chugach too. I'd be curious how many hours RCA staff spent just on Chugach's two community solar applications, because I can and will assume that Chugach spent at least that many hours themselves. And I want to, you know, one of the things I think about is minimizing admin burden for our electric utility in Anchorage. Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding of the bill before us is kind of formulaic, kind of a housekeeping kind of bill to how RCA and RAPA can get the funds they need to, frankly, to do the job they have right now, regulating the utility situation we have right now. I'm concerned that we're getting into energy policy questions in which, well, while RCA is going to play a role, other elements of our system, the legislature, the governor, utilities themselves will play roles too. So I'm not quite sure how fair it is to have these two ladies here to talk about this bill and the funding to get into larger, broader issues of energy policy. Just want to offer consideration to our witnesses.
Well, thank you, Representative Sadler. The bill certainly has an interesting title, though. Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, in agreement with Chair Sumner, thank you. I think the truth is my question that I'm about to ask on power cost equalization. Fortunately, when RCA is asking for an increase to the statutory cap, everything that RCA does is now under the microscope to say, should that cost that, and should those people do that? And so I guess a question for the representatives here, how many people are employed in the sphere of power cost equalization program with RCA currently?
So through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, we have one financial analyst that the majority of their part is dealing with rural non-regulated PCE, and then the tariff section, which is currently has four positions, and currently three of those filled, dealing with calculation of power cost equalization in addition to the other items. And then we have some clerical staff that helps with the clerical pieces of it. And that's about, so five, four dealing with calculation, and then one administratively.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. Just to follow up to that, and with this potential statutory cap increase, if that revenue were to come in, where would some of the staffing needs be greatest that you could see the RCA putting that towards? Where are some of the greatest needs right now?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, we have a number, several analyst positions that are currently vacant, and so looking to kind of try to fill through analysts and some of the other support staff. Anything more to add?
We're going to take a brief at ease. I'm going to turn the meeting over to Representative Ruffridge for a little while. So at ease.
Skip here for a little bit. So where were we? Representative Carrick.
I just had a follow-up. The previous question was which vacancies, where are you seeing the highest vacancies? And you mentioned analyst positions. Are those within the PCE program? Just a little bit more specifically, I guess, where are some of the greatest personnel needs right now for the RCA in managing specific programs?
Through the vice chair, Representative Carrick, I would say some of our needs, they kind of it, through our like our even through our records and filing or our intake, everything that we receive through into the commission comes through our records and filing section. The advisory section, which is where the analysts are, there's a few vacancies there. And then just getting some additional, as we get into more potential energy issues, even in our, like our engineering staff. So far, everything that we've handled specific to PCE has been handled with our current staffing. Some of it is just a little bit more of the technical expertise.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? I guess the last one I had, just kind of in that same line of questioning, is should this bill go through and additional dollars be coming in? I guess with the current vacancies and all of the things that are currently within the department, or I guess within the regulatory commission, why do you think an increase would be necessary with a 33% vacancy rate? Is there some other cost that you think will be significantly altered in the upcoming 2 years? Or do you foresee the need to hire additional people on top of the 20 or more people that are not currently filled positions?
Vice Chair Ruffridge, I can't speak 100% to that. I know that as we look, kind of depending what also comes out from a legislative session, potentially having some additional needs for personnel. And as Ms. Johnston indicated, RAPA is currently at their statutory cap, and RAPA will intervene in cases before the commission as part of the public interest and to ensure that the public interest. I guess I'm not prepared to know if there's additional things that we would need in the future if the outside of what has been projected in our budget. But I do know with where our statutory cap is now, based on our projections, that we will exceed it. And I know we are working to fill our vacancies.
If I may add, for the record, Naomi Johnston, Admin Operations Manager with Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Over the last couple years, we've had quite a significant increase in some of our fixed costs. Our lease went up by a considerable amount. We're in a 10-year lease. So there's certain things that have been out of our control that have increased our budget by an unexpected amount. There's also some things on the horizon that we are trying to prepare for. There is a capital proposal to try and replace our case management software. There's other projects that we're kind of looking at to help streamline, create efficiencies, such as possibly digitizing, you know, a vast amount of records and making that available. So there's several different projects on the horizon that this will hopefully allow us the ability to have the flexibility within our budget to be able to manage and complete and move forward.
And not to belabor the point, but potentially there could be a capital request for some of those issues rather than a long-term statutory cap increase on some of those things, particularly if the goal is to provide efficiency. Maybe this being passed along to Alaskan residents might not be needed if some of those efficiencies are found. Any other comments or questions? Okay. Well, thank you for your presentation today. I will set this bill aside for a future hearing, and I will take a brief at ease. During the brief at ease, while we transition to HB 324, potentially we could sign your bill sheet before we get too far away. So brief at ease. On record in House Labor and Commerce. Next, we will have the first bill hearing on HB 324, Insurance Data Security, from Representative Stapp. Thank you for joining us, Representative Stapp. Please come to the table and put your name on the record and introduce yourself, your staff, and introduce us to your bill.
All right. For the record, my name is Representative Will Stapp, and I will be presenting HB 324 regarding cybersecurity and data security and insurance stuff today.
Staff, before you do that, I actually made an error. I think we have a committee substitute for this bill that we should adopt first so we're all on the same page, and then you can present that as well as the summary of changes, because I think that was on the intention for the day. So, Representative Wright, did you have a motion for that committee substitute? It's this one right here, HB 324.
24.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill HB 324, version Bravo. Brief at ease.
Brief at ease. Back on record, Representative Wright.
Thank you, Chair Ruffridge. I move to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill number 324, version Bravo, also referred to as 33LS1348, Bravo.
Thank you.
Object for discussion.
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Did you like to speak to your objection?
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll remove my objection.
Okay. Is there any further objection? Okay, hearing none, committee substitute for House Bill 324 has been adopted. Thank you for the allowance to do that, Representative Stapp. Please proceed.
Thank you, Vice Chair Ruffridge. Through the chair,
And for the record, my name is Representative Will Stapp. So I'm going to go ahead and probably give a little brief synopsis of the bill and then turn it over to my staff, Clifton Coghill, for summary of the changes in the CS and to read the sectional of the bill and what it actually does. So basically, folks, we have a kind of a pretty important topic today in this bill. It's insurance data security. It is paramount in this digital age that we're in with in terms of cybersecurity. I think everyone at this table is probably well aware of all the data breaches that have happened throughout the state. Kind of insurance is no different. Most insurance companies have actually taken steps to mitigate the risk in terms of data breaches and being good stewards of folks' private information. What this bill attempts to do is basically set a uniform standard to allow the Division of Insurance to be able to regulate those companies to ensure that we are upholding really our constitutional provision of right to privacy and ensuring that we can go through and maintain proper risk assessment of different information security programs to ensure that consumers in the state's information is protected as much as possible. I don't think you can ever kind of devise a system in which individuals' personal information is always going to be protected in the modern age, but I think that this bill will go take one step forward to establishing a good regulatory framework that we can ensure that individuals' data security is protected. So a lot of technical aspects of this bill, so I'll turn it over to my staff, Clifton Coghill, and I'll read the summary changes in CS and to go over the sectional, and then I'll take questions if folks have them. So
thank you, Mr. Coghill.
Clifton Coghill, staff for Representative Stapp. So the summary changes for HB 324 from version A to the CS is a structural change. All the sections of the bill moved from AS 2196 to AS 2123. The Legal Services Division felt that the topic of the bill would fit better under risk management in the Alaska statutes. Throughout the bill, all changes, all the references are changed from 72 hours to 3 business days instead. And then the rest of the changes are all in section one. You have page 1, line 5, which adds a new section, purpose and construction to establish exclusivity standard. Page 2, line 1 through 5, adds clarifying language. Consumer rate with the size and complexity of the licensee and consideration of the nature and scope of the licensee's activities and being used by, on, or in possession or control of said licensee. Page 4, line 2 through 4, adds clarifying language that the licensee shall adopt procedures for testing the security of externally developed applications used by the licensee. Page 5, line 2 through 9, also adds clarifying language. Where appropriate, encrypted non-public information is not considered as accessible to or held by the third-party service provider if the associated protective process or key necessary to assign meaning to the non-public information is not within the possession of the third-party service provider. Whew. Okay. All right. So page 8, line 8 through 10, changes law enforcement official to be exclusively the federal law enforcement. There were concerns that the law enforcement would be too broad. Subsection A, unless a federal law enforcement official instructs the licensee not to distribute information regardless of cybersecurity events. All right, so page...
Just 1 sec. Representative Fields? Do you want us to ask questions during the sectional or at the end?
Let's do it at the end. Thank you.
I have a question here.
Yes, continue.
All right, so page 8, line 25 through 26, more clarifying language, subsection B, to the greatest extent possible and in the form and format prescribed by the director. Page 10, line 27 through 28, except to provide in F and G of this section, a licensee acting as an assuming insurer. Page 11, line 9 through 23, clarifies reporting requirements regarding the insurers and insurance producers. J, an insurer shall notify an insurance producer of a cybersecurity event involving non-public information no later than the date of the notice is provided to the affected customers if, one, the non-public information is in the possession or control of licensee that is an insurer or the licensee's third-party service provider. Sorry. Two, the consumer access the insurer's service through an insurance producer, and three, the insurer is required to notify the affected consumer. Page 13, line 1 through 5, basically clarifies that the director cannot share privileged information without the written consent of licensees. And page 14 through 15 clarifies some definitions. Of note, the definition of non-public information is expanded thereupon. And that would be it. Thank you,
Mr. Coghill. Representative Fields, you had a question on the sectional analysis.
Yes, and I suspect through the chair my question is, maybe for Ms. Winghire, but I guess the sponsor might know this. So you said that you had heard concerns about law enforcement, and I just don't know the history. Have local or state law enforcement been involved with security breaches in the past? And I guess who articulated the concern about law enforcement being broader? Thank you.
With permission of the chair, I'd like to bring up Commissioner Heyer.
Absolutely. Welcome, Ms. Winghire.
Thank you.
Thank you. Feels like you should have your own special chair at this committee.
I probably should. For the record, my name is Lori Winghire. I'm the director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. Through the chair to Representative Fields, when the original bill was introduced, the insurance industry came back, and there was a discussion that if there was a cyber breach, and they were also working with the FBI or the Department of Justice, that they might not have to report to the Division of Insurance. Yet under McCarran Ferguson, we are their regulator. So what we compromised on was that they still have to report to the division, but if at some point the FBI or the Department of Justice, a federal law enforcement agency, says you can't talk to the division about this, then we would understand that. But our mission would be to make sure that the consumers in Alaska receive notice, and then the investigation would proceed from there.
Great. Thank you for that question. While Ms. Winghire is here, can I ask a follow-up question?
Please.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Winghire, I see half of the other states have adopted some version of this bill. How much variation is there across the states in terms of following the NAIC language, or is it really cookie-cutter in all these states? And if so, is it cookie-cutter in this case too, or are there state-specific factors that you built in with the bill sponsor? Thank you.
Through the chair again, Representative Fields, there's nothing Alaska built in. There were some discussions such as, should we exempt agencies with 10 employees, 15 employees, things like that, where states were a little bit different, but we didn't give up on any major deviations from the NAIC model law.
Thank you. Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. That's actually where my question was going to go, is why the exemption for 10 or fewer, and how does that look in other states?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, 10 is the number that was in the NAIC model, and they did it just because they thought the cost to a very small agency would be prohibitive. Now, keep in mind that if you're a State Farm or an Allstate or an agent like that, you're going to get what this bill asks for cybersecurity data protection from the State Farm or Allstate. So those smaller agencies that are direct writers would rely on the company, the insurer itself.
And just to follow up, the intent would be that the larger company would, this language would cover the larger company, which would therefore cover the small entities. So in other words, every insurer in the state would be covered by this language in some form or fashion.
Yeah. If Director Heyer, if I may, thank you, Representative Carrick, through the chair, as Representative Stapp. So, two aspects of the bill. One is on the insurance and the insurer side, and the other is on the producer side. So the number you're referencing is actually relevant to 10 folks at a producer firm, right? So the large insurance companies are already going to do some aspect of this anyways. The commissioner referenced Allstate or State Farm. So those companies are, you know, have way more, you know, staff than that, and they have each individual agency. So those companies have their own procedures, and this bill basically allows our commissioner to ensure that the regulations is standardized throughout. So each big company has some different aspect of cybersecurity that they do, typically already if they're one of the big insurers. Stuff that you're going to read in the bill, like two-step
authentication. You know, like that's very standard throughout the industry nowadays. But really, this bill just is allowed to set a regulatory framework at the state level because states' Division of Insurance still regulate that practice individually across 50 states, right? So that's something kind of unique in different types of aspects. But states' DOIs regulate that stuff. So that answers the question.
Other questions or comments while Ms. Winghire is with us? All right, seeing none, thank you. Representative Stapp, was there anything further that you would like us to know about this bill before we set it aside?
Through the chair to members of the committee. So this is there's a Senate companion to this bill. So and there are a couple things in this bill that I tend to maybe should be tweaked, and I'll certainly talk with the members of the committee. But I am working with the sponsor and the other body to kind of address those things too. As far as the number, Representative Carrick, that's NAIC language as far as number. I don't know if that number 10 is really applicable to any kind of agency in the state. So maybe you could make that number 15 or something. I don't think it would really matter. But overall, there's been a lot of work done on it, and it's very technical. And I would say needed to, even though I don't like additional regulatory things that I'll have to do personally. So.
Thank you, Representative Stapp. Any other questions or comments before we move on? All right, seeing none, thank you for being here today. Thank you for giving us that introduction. We will set this bill aside and for a future hearing, and we will have public testimony then. We will now take a brief at ease while we move on to HB 55. Brief at ease. All right, we are back on record. We are joined at the table, Representative Carrick, with House Bill 55, Extend Workforce Investment Board Allocation. We heard this bill on Friday, and today we have our invited testimony from the University of Alaska. Before we get started, Representative Carrick, is there anything we need to know before we get started?
For the record, Ashley Carrick, representative for House District 35, and we have had an introduction of this legislation last week. So I will just be available to answer any questions regarding the legislation or the policy.
Very good. Thank you very much. And I guess for the University of Alaska, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Sure. Good afternoon through the chair. My name is Sarah Perman, and I'm the Government Relations Manager for the University of Alaska. I'm actually just going to be flipping slides here, and we have Terry Cothran, Associate Vice President of Workforce Development, online, and she'll be giving this presentation.
Very good. Thank you. Terry Cothran is online, Associate VP of Workforce Development. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Terry Cothran, Associate Vice President of Workforce Development at the University of Alaska. And just check that my sound's coming through okay.
We hear you well.
Great. I want to thank Co-Chair Sumner and Ruffridge and members of the committee for the opportunity to talk with you about the reauthorization of TVEP, and also thank Representatives Carrick and Foster for co-sponsoring HB 55. I'm going to keep my testimony brief today, but it does not minimize the critical importance of this funding to help upskill and reskill Alaskans for high-demand jobs in Alaska. Next slide. I'm going to start with a 20,000-foot level to provide a bit of context for the generational opportunity in front of us that adds to the importance of reauthorizing TVEP. Because of the billions in federal funding for infrastructure projects, the skilled workforce needs are going to steadily increase over the coming years. And TVEP provides stable funding to train Alaskans for these projects, and especially for the legacy jobs that will really help maintain the infrastructure long-term. Next slide. And going from the 20,000-foot view, let's zoom in a bit to the University of Alaska. It is the largest and most comprehensive workforce provider in the state, and also key to meeting Alaska's workforce needs. Our three separately accredited universities with their distinct missions are also responsible for serving the community college mission through 13 community campuses that provide access to career and technical education across all six of Alaska's economic regions. Next slide. This is a summary of nearly 27,000 graduates' employment outcomes that's represented across 11 industries really important to Alaska's economy. And it was a project in partnership with Department of Labor and Workforce Development's research and analysis. You can see here in the data that education pays. And specific to programs that take that target, the short-term certificate and associate programs, graduates are out-earning the average Alaska wage by their fifth year of employment. And another important point to note is that 94.8% of these working graduates are Alaska residents, and really highlights the importance of training our own to retain talent in state with those who are committed to living in Alaska. TVEP is important to strengthening the university's ability to produce these outcomes and makes the reauthorization of TVEP really critical in addressing the state's workforce needs. Next slide. Specific to TVEP, each year we collaborate with Department of Labor and Workforce Development on the annual TVEP report that is in your committee's documents and demonstrates performance outcomes. In this year's report, you will see that the University of Alaska utilized its 45% TVEP allocation to train 57% of the students. That was almost 5,000 Alaskans who overall had an 80% employment rate and includes nearly 1,300 high school students in dual enrollment programs. UA distributes our single TVEP allocation as a result of a competitive grant process that is inclusive of all campuses and programs in the UA system that are aligned to state-identified priorities and the intent of TVEP. Next slide. This is an overview of the industries University of Alaska TVEP funding is supporting. These are aligned to Alaska Workforce Investment Board's priority industries and serving all six of Alaska's economic regions. I want to also mention here that the Fairbanks Pipeline Training Center does receive a portion of UA's 45% allocation as pass-through funding based on a 2008 fiscal note and their efforts specifically support construction, oil, and gas. Next slide. These are the performance outcomes reflected in the TVEP annual report and highlight how efficiently this funding is utilized to train Alaskans. Collectively, across all 10 TVEP recipients, there were over 8,500 trained in FY23 for an average cost of just over $1,600 per participant. So between the statewide reach of UA's campuses and the other 9 TVEP recipients, we are providing multiple access points to career and technical education across Alaska. And last slide, in conclusion, the University of Alaska strongly supports the reauthorization of TVEP to provide stable funding to address Alaska's growing workforce needs. And we are committed as a university to continuing to align with the Alaska Workforce Investment Board's identified industry priorities and also really ensuring that we are demonstrating outcomes in alignment with TVEP performance criteria. I thank you for your time today, and this concludes my remarks.
And thank you for your presentation. Looks like we have a question from Representative Fields.
Hi, Ms. Cothran, through the chair. I was wondering if you could just go back one slide. Thank you. So I see that Amundsen Education Center received $274,000 and trained, it looks like, 5 people. If they spent the average amount per recipient, maybe that would be more like 130 people. So if the legislature were to allocate that $274,000, keep it on the Kenai Peninsula and invest it at the Kenai River and Kachemak Bay campuses, what are some of the training programs that those residents of the Kenai might enjoy? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, our Kenai Peninsula College is one of our largest community or campus colleges serving a community college mission in the University of Alaska system. And they have programs from process technology, which is one of their premier programs that was started in partnership with the oil and gas industry back in the early 2000s. And They also have welding programs. They serve also general education requirements as a pathway into other degree programs. And I can get you some additional examples, but those are a couple to name. And currently, I believe they're serving over 1,700 students through the Kenai Peninsula College.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions, Representative Sadler?
Thank you. I do have a question. Ms. Catherine, yeah, I'm looking at slide 7 where it kind of breaks out the number of people served and costs and so forth. And I'm kind of it's struck by, although AvTech is a statewide program serving about roughly 1,200, Losavik on the slope has about 800. So I'm just wondering what kind of accounts for that, what would seem to be a disparity. Statewide population, we have about 750,000 people, and the North Slope has, you know, far less than that. Yet there's 800 students, most of them adults. Just what allows for the high utilization rates of adults at Losavik College?
Through the chair, thank you for that question. I, being a University of Alaska representative, I wouldn't be able to speak to Losavik and AvTech's outcomes directly.
Representative Kerr?
Through the chair, just briefly to Representative Sadler, I think it's valuable to note that Losavik also is a hub campus for a lot of communities on the North Slope and the Western Arctic. So their numbers may be higher just because they are providing training to a pretty large region outside of just the community of Ukiagvik where they're located.
And through the chair, I appreciate the understanding with the UA. Just you're more familiar with the overall program inside your slides, so I just had to ask. Thank you. And thanks, Bill.
Any other questions or comments for university or bill sponsor? Okay. Seeing none, thank you very much for your presentation and for your testimony. I will set this bill aside for a later hearing date for public testimony, and we will set an amendment deadline, I'm sure, on that bill as well. So I guess we will take a brief at ease while we transition to the next bill. Brief at ease. We are back on record. Last on today's agenda is HB 226, Pharmacies, Pharmacists, a bill sponsored by Representative Sumner. We did hear this bill already, and today we are going to have public testimony, and we are going to have to set a time limit of a very strict 2 minutes in order to get through the testifiers that we have online. If you do get cut off and don't get the chance to submit the entirety of your testimony, please email the committee afterwards, and we're always happy to take written testimony. So that being said, public testimony on HB 226 is now open. Is there anyone in the room wanting to testify on HB 226? Please, sir, introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony, and you have 2 minutes.
For the record, my name is Brian Ridley, and I'm the Chief Chairman of the Tanana Chiefs Conference. Thank you for the opportunity to provide public testimony in strong support for House Bill 226 today. As you all have heard from previous testimony in support of HB 226, patients and pharmacies in Alaska are currently in a state of financial crisis. Prescription drugs are becoming unaffordable for patients, employers, the state of Alaska, and the American taxpayer. There are around 70 pharmacy benefit managers in the U.S. right now. Through mergers, just three of them control 80% of the prescription drug market. Each of these three also own a health insurer, a large franchise pharmacy, and large medical providers. Each bring in tens of billions of dollars in revenue annually. This type of profit is because PBMs control all aspects of the prescription drug food chain, from pricing, coverage, cost control, where prescriptions can be filled, and at what ultimate cost to the employer and patient. Tribal health organizations are the only healthcare option in many of the rural communities across our state, and our ability to continue to provide pharmacy services to Alaska Natives, American Indians, veterans, and non-natives in our bush communities is in serious jeopardy due to the practices of PBMs. We have calculated the negative financial impact of PBMs on our pharmacy's bottom line at a loss of more than $4 million annually. We also calculated that the state of Alaska is spending nearly $8 million more annually using the current PBM contract than it would under the provisions laid out in HB 226. This bill will save patients money. It will revive Alaska's struggling private sector pharmacies and strengthen our public health sector. The status quo of an unregulated PBM industry is completely unacceptable and will lead to devastating consequences for patients, pharmacies, and THOs like TCC. I urge you to move HB 226 out of the Labor and Commerce Committee as fast as possible if you want to save the state money. Thank you, Masi Cho, for the opportunity to speak to you today regarding this critically important issue.
Thank you. Representative Fields, I will allow a question, but we really do have to get through public testimony and have limited time to do so.
Thank you. Through the chair, appreciate the testimony. Is the Title 21 language in this bill the primary language that has an impact on tribal health providers, or is it more the Title 39 language affecting our Alaska Care and ERISA plans? Thank you.
Boy, that I'm not sure of.
Okay. No problem. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Ridley? All right, hearing none, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room wishing to testify on House Bill 226? Okay, seeing none, we'll move online. We have first up is Tammy Thiel. Please introduce yourself for the record, begin your testimony, and you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. On behalf of Denali Oncology Group, DOG, I'm actually testifying to express our strong support for HB 226, which seeks to regulate the harmful practices of white bagging and brown bagging policies employed by insurers and pharmacy benefit managers, PBM. DOG is an organization whose primary mission is to promote, support, represent, advocate for, conduct educational and scientific activities throughout Alaska for the practice of oncology and the delivery of care to patients for the benefit of citizens and residents of the state of Alaska. White bagging and brown bagging policies require that patient medications be delivered through an insurer or PBM designated specialty pharmacy rather than allowing providers to acquire and dispense these medications directly. This can lead to many issues for patients and providers, including the improper delivery and storage of medications, delays in care, and medical waste. We believe that healthcare providers, in consultation with their patients, should maintain the ability to choose the most appropriate sources for obtaining and administering necessary medications. This is critical to ensuring the highest standards of care and safeguarding patient safety throughout the treatment process. By preserving the ability of oncologists to manage the procurement and administration of medication through the established and trusted channels, this legislation will help protect the well-being of cancer patients in Alaska and ensure they receive the highest quality of care in a timely manner. For these reasons, Denali Oncology Group asked the committee to pass HB 226. Thank you.
Well, for those of you who are listening, that was a perfect two-minute testimony. So props to Ms. Thiel for that work. Next, we have James Lee. Please introduce yourself for the record. Begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you for the opportunity to provide public comment in support of House Bill 226. My name is James Lee, and I'm here today representing the Community Oncology Alliance, COA. COA is the only nonprofit organization in the United States dedicated solely to independent community oncology practices, which serve the majority of Americans receiving treatment for cancer. As a representative of community practices in Alaska, we firmly believe that white and brown bagging practices threaten patient safety, compromise treatment efficacy, and pose significant challenges to the continuity of care for Alaskans living with cancer. White and brown bagging refer to the process where insurers and PBMs affiliated specialty pharmacies mail or deliver cancer medications directly to a physician's office or to the patient's home, rather than allowing the patient's oncologist to directly handle and dispense their medications. This practice is increasingly mandated by health plans and pharmacy benefit managers, under the presumption of assumed cost savings However, these processes raise significant concerns for community oncologists and pose substantial risks for patients that ultimately increase the financial burden of the disease. Under white and brown bagging insurer policies, the integrity and safety of these highly specialized and often fragile cancer medications cannot be guaranteed once they leave the controlled environment of their affiliated specialty pharmacy. Improper handling, storage, or temperature control during shipping can compromise the efficacy of the drugs, ultimately impacting patient outcomes. Additionally, the insertion of untrained individuals, such as patients or family caregivers, into the drug distribution chain introduces unnecessary variables that can truly compromise the patient's treatment process. The insurer policies disrupt continuity of care and impede the ability of oncologists to make timely adjustments to treatment regimens. Because of the policies, dosage changes, which are common in cancer care, may be delayed due to the need to reorder and await delivery of new medication, often further complicating a patient's health. Furthermore, due to these mandates, any unused medications cannot be repurposed, leading to significant waste of these often exceptionally expensive drugs.
Can you please?
BOA firmly believes that Alaskans living with cancer deserve uncompromised care with their treatment overseas and managed by experienced local oncologists. We urge you to support House Bill 226 and take a stand against these harmful insurer policies.
And thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Tony Neal. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Tanya Neal. I am the Senior Director of State Affairs for PCMA, the National Trade Association for PBMs. PBMs provide services for more than 350,000 Alaskans. Today, I'm here to express our opposition to House Bill 226, which poses significant challenges to healthcare affordability and access due to cost increases and restrictions in plan design. First, I want to clarify that PBMs operate within a highly regulated framework overseen by several federal agencies, including the Department of Health, Department of Labor, Treasury, and Office of Personnel Management, as well as adhering to state laws and industry standards. Our role is not to unilaterally set pharmacy access or out-of-pocket costs. Rather, we serve as a service provider for health plans, trusts, and governments facilitating cost-effective drug distribution and access. Drug pricing is dictated by manufacturers, with PBMs promoting the use of generic alternatives, which account for 90% of dispensed prescriptions in the U.S. 10% of drugs are brands, and specialty drugs are responsible for about 82.5% of the cost, according to the Association for Accessible Medicines. Due to this imbalance, we ask you to look at the whole supply chain, not just the one entity involved in this bill. Specialty pharmacies focus on high cost and high touch medications, usually for patients with complex health conditions. Specialty drugs are not self-administered. The medication is typically sent to the provider's office to administer for things such as infusion therapy. You'll see that with cancer drugs. Specialty drugs may require special handling, storage, and administration. House Bill 226 suggests shifting to NADAC pricing and mandates profit guarantees for pharmacies. NADAC pricing doesn't reflect true net pharmacy acquisition costs. It lags behind real-time marketing, and the reimbursement floors can force insured patients to pay more for drugs. Less than 1% of U.S. pharmacies participate in cost reporting with NADAC. A mandate to change to NADAC will increase costs to Alaskans without a benefit. There are only 3 states that utilize a form of NADAC for the commercial insurance market currently. Moreover, the bill's approach to pharmacy networks and specialty drugs could compromise both costs and patient safety by undermining the specialty drugs, specialty care, and some conditions that are required.
If you could,
we are standing here ready to work with anybody and everybody on making this bill better and more affordable for Alaska as this moves through the process. Thank you.
And thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Ballard Saul. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon. My name is Ballard Saul, the clinical pharmacy manager at Providence Alaska Medical Center, and I'm here this afternoon to voice my strong support for House Bill 226, both as a pharmacist and as a community member. As a pharmacist, the current practices of PBMs, including white and brown bagging, pose a threat to the well-being of the patients that I care for. White and brown bagging hinder our ability as a pharmacist to ensure the delivery of safe and effective therapy for our patients because we are unable to certify the integrity of the medication that we are expected to oversee administered to our patients. For example, last month, we had a medication with an excursion outside of the appropriate temperature range. Therefore, we had to remove this medication from stock, return it to the drug company, and order new product to replace this medication. All of this was to ensure our patients are safely and effectively taken care of. Had this medication been shipped directly to the patient's home or directly to the provider's office, the integrity of the supply chain could not be confirmed. Which would you prefer for you or your loved one? A supply chain that is managed by individuals that have dedicated their entire lives through education and training? A supply chain comprised of healthcare facilities that have invested millions of dollars to ensure that the medication you receive is going to be both safe and effective? Or rely on a supply chain that has very few checks and balances to ensure the medication is handled appropriately? I can imagine what you would prefer, but to provide further evidence, I was having a conversation with an employee of a drug manufacturing company the other day. They were meeting with me to discuss one of their products and about providing it to patients in Alaska. During the conversation, they told me, we avoid shipping utilizing this specific carrier because we are unable to confirm that we can get the medication to the patient's home without the product freezing on the tarmac, and the medication cannot be frozen. From my professional standpoint, I would argue that white and or brown bagging is a medication safety concern anywhere, but I wholeheartedly believe that given the unique challenges to the supply chain in Alaska, this practice is absolutely concerning.
Thank you.
Please take action on this bill. Thank you.
Next, we have Shauna King. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Shauna King, and I am a pharmacist at Providence Alaska Medical Center, and I live in Anchorage. Thank you for allowing me to give testimony today. As both a pharmacist and an Alaskan, I am in strong favor of House Bill 226. The lack of PBM regulation in Alaska is allowing mail order only practice by insurance companies, which is causing local pharmacies across the state to close their doors. This is limiting access to medications for all of us. And it not only impacts the appropriate management of chronic diseases, but it also limits access to medications needed to treat urgent medical issues. Antibiotics is a perfect example. This should be very concerning for all of us. In addition to the unfair trade practices by PBMs that do not equally reimburse local pharmacies, PBMs claim to reduce medication costs but have failed to provide transparent evidence of medication cost savings to patients. I have concerns not only as a pharmacist practicing in this state, but also for myself, my family, my friends, and my patients. Specifically related to white bagging, brown bagging practices required by PBMs, several home infusion pharmacies and infusion centers have also closed in Anchorage due to the negative financial impact. The infusion center at Providence Alaska Medical Center is not in support of these practices because it compromises our patient safety. There is unclear chain of medication custody, which violates the FDA Supply Chain Security Act, and appropriate therapy is often delayed for patients because of the known shipping issues for specialty medications, especially to Alaska. Thank you for considering this bill and all the great work you do for our state.
Thank you. Next, we have Catherine Kowalski. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Oh, sorry. Next, we have Leif Holm. Please put your name on in your testimony.
Hi, my name is Leif Holm. I am the owner of Alaska Family Pharmacy. I'm testifying in support of 226. Our group of pharmacies has been open in Fairbanks and North Pole since 1960. We began as a group of three stores, combining in 2010 and growing with the addition of Alaska's first independent telepharmacy in Healy in 2017 to become what is now collectively known as Alaska Family Pharmacy. We grew into four stores over a number of years serving the interior of Alaska with plans to expand, but we've now consolidated into two. Our telepharmacy, feeling a need in an underserved area, was forced to close, becoming unsustainable, not because of lack of demand or support from the community, but because of the unfair reimbursement practices that buried us monthly to the point we cut our losses. In 2022, open since the late 1970s, another of our pharmacies was forced to close as well, attributed to our employee crisis, which was and still is consistently exacerbated by the lack of capital due to consistently inadequate reimbursement. Currently, we are the only independent pharmacy in the interior of Alaska. In 2022, the other independent in Fairbanks closed down, and I'm aware of two independent locations in Juneau that closed down recently as well. Clearly, this is an alarming trend, and we continue to struggle with reimbursement issues. PBMs will testify that I'm just trying to get rich at the expense of patients, but that couldn't be further from the truth. I'm a second-generation pharmacist and care about my community and my customers. I have my faults, but I don't believe I'm an isolated case of just being a terrible businessman. Demand is increasing, prices are increasing, overhead is increasing, and our reimbursements are shrinking. That math doesn't add up. Having no ability to set our price, no other business has such little power to deal with the inflation happening in our society. It's a difficult to believe business model, but that is the reality that we as pharmacists attempt to operate in on a daily basis. Thank you again for your time and attention to the matter. I would appreciate your support of this bill and the sustainability of local pharmacy in Alaska.
Thank you. Next, we have Samantha Urban. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Samantha Urban. I'm a pharmacist working in Tok and testifying today on my own behalf. I am calling in to voice my support for House Bill 226. Tok opened its first pharmacy in June of 2021. In the almost 3 years that I've been a pharmacist here, I've become increasingly concerned in regards to current PBM practices. Having a pharmacy in rural Alaska is very, very beneficial to rural patients who already have a limited access to care. Before we opened, patients used mail order pharmacies or drove up to 8 hours round trip for their chronic medication needs. If these critical medications came from a mail order pharmacy, they arrived with no counseling support on how to use complicated devices or special ways to take their medications or which side effects to watch for. If it was a medication that they needed acutely, for instance, antibiotics or something for acute pain, the closest pharmacy that we had was Delta Junction, which is an hour and a half away. There have been many, many times that patients have come to me voicing their gratitude on us opening a pharmacy here in Tok. Because of PBM practices, this puts a threat to all small rural pharmacies in Alaska, as you've heard in testimonies before. Some of the concerns that I've dealt with are forced copays to use local pharmacies. Many rural patients have limited income and simply can't afford the copays. Patients not using inhalers properly or not being able to set up their inhalers, so not using them due to no counseling support. Mail order pharmacies' refusal to send out diabetic medication for risk of freezing, resulting in a lapse in care. Patients bringing in medication that were stopped by their providers, but the mail orders just keep sending them. Sending critical life-saving medications late and patients depending on local pharmacies to supply them to prevent a lapse in care and having to pay again. These are just a small example of concerns which arise with current PBM practices. Please consider the health and well-being of all Alaskans and support this bill. I'm grateful for the option to use mail order pharmacies. However, let's keep it as an option. Right now, the way things are progressing, it's not an option for many, but a must. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Next, we have Darlene Huntington. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Darlene Huntington. I currently live in Fairbanks and am originally from Utqiagvik, Alaska, and I am representing myself today. In my current day-to-day role as a village pharmacist, I primarily serve patients residing in villages throughout interior Alaska. Most of the patients I serve are not connected to a road system. They cannot simply walk down the street to their local pharmacy to rectify a prescription that has been damaged in transit or damaged due to weather. At times, the local post office may often be unavailable for long periods of time due to postmaster staffing shortages. These are critical steps for patient procurement of their medications. Through the PBM mail order system, we have experienced patient medications stuck in the U.S. Postal Service for extended periods of time and thus having to be wasted because the medication has gone out of an acceptable temperature storage range. In rural Alaska, we deal with several logistical challenges related to extreme weather, mostly unpredicted, but also semi-predicted. For example, right now we are prospectively preparing medications to be sent to patients before our spring breakup season happens. Prior to our spring breakup, we have patients who must take a boat to their neighboring villages where the local post office is located to pick up their medications. Our prospective efforts include working closely with the healthcare team to ensure appropriate labs have been completed and reviewed and that all prescriptions are in place and that no prescription is missed. When this spring breakup happens, some of our patients cannot cross the river and do not have access to a package delivery system until the river is safe to cross over. These are the real-life scenarios and challenges that happen on a regular basis for patients living in our rural communities, and the current PBM model does not accommodate to that, nor does it provide an acceptable level of care and diligence that we are able to provide for our patients as pharmacists here in Alaska. Bottom line is that the PBM model does not fit or serve the logistical challenges of communities in rural Alaska
and I hope that you will consider this and support House Bill 226.
Next, we have Jerry Brown. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Jerry Brown. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I was born in the territory, graduated from Lake and Price School, and I've raised my kids here. My wife and I moved back to the state in 1992. We've practiced pharmacy for 46 years and had recently, about 10 years ago, bought a legacy pharmacy in Fairbanks, which has a 56-year Alaska history. It's only been owned by three other owners before this. I have a daughter that is a pharmacist in the state and wished to be able to hand it down to her, but with this economic climate that the PBMs are exuding on us, I don't feel in good conscience that I could sell this to my daughter or any other young pharmacist in the state. A reminder, government, the purpose of government is to provide and develop infrastructure for the state of Alaska and develop rules of conduct through legislation to provide a, and via a stable tax base to via tax base and other review strategies to guide the future of the state of Alaska. So we are that's where this committee should be looking at. I urgently hope that you will pass House Bill 226, as this has actually caused our pharmacy, my wife and I, to lose our pharmacy because of the negative revenue that is being forced on us by the PBM. The gross margins have gone from 10 years ago from about 22% to 2%. And if you consider 2% gross margin on a $1 million sale, that's about $20,000. On a $5 million scale, which is the chain stores, that's about $100,000 gross margin, which makes it so that you can't hire enough pharmacists and or staff to conduct business. And so you're running negative revenues. And we were running between $2,000 and $7,000 in negative revenues over the course of the of each month. So we actually make more money collecting Social Security.
Next, we have Dirk White. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chairman Sumner and committee members for hearing this bill. For the record, I'm Dirk White, a pharmacist serving Sitka and surrounding communities here in Southeast Alaska. I'm in support of House Bill 226 and ask that you move this bill out of committee today. This is urgent legislation that needs to be heard on the floor and in the Senate and moved on to the governor. The retail pharmacy world is under attack by pharmacy benefit managers. They have a very hidden agenda to close all of their competition as soon as possible, which has been creating healthcare deserts all across the United States and even greater ones here in the state. Today, just today, we had two patients, which is probably the tip of the iceberg, two patients call us to say that Optum, the state's pharmacy benefit manager, called them to try and move them to mail order pharmacies out of state. It's just an egregious policy. I mean, this is the Alaska's retirees and active employee pharmacy benefit manager, and they're trying to remove patients from our care and get them to go to mail order. Again, the tip of the iceberg. How many other patients have been called that didn't bother to call us? This pulls monies from our fragile state economy. We're isolated on an island. There's no other economic engines here. The PBMs must be stopped. They only care about their profits and not the people, our citizens, our constituents, or their health. I strongly support House Bill 226 and ask that you move legislation out of committee today and get it onto the floor so we can get it heard there and move forward to the governor. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next is Megan Penner. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, thank you for having me. My name is Megan. I am a pharmacist and one of the faculty members at the UAA ISU College of Pharmacy, but I'm here to represent myself. As a patient and military spouse and recent cornea transplant recipient, I've seen the impact of PBMs on medication access. Limited pharmacies carry the eye drops I need, and PBMs have forced TRICARE's hand on restricting where I can get my prescriptions filled in Eagle River. This has resulted in significant delays in accessing the medications I need for my transplant. This bill would protect our patients like me. As a hospital pharmacist, I see the impact of PBMs and transitions of care. I often have to worry that patients will not be able to receive their prescriptions in a timely manner because of PBMs. As an educator, I see the impact of PBMs on where our new graduates can work. We're seeing decreased opportunities for them in our small local pharmacies, so I ask you to support this bill to increase access for our patients like me. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Mark Bower. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Mark Bower. Thank you, Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to provide testimony today. I am a pharmacist and the pharmacy practice coordinator for Fred Meyer in Alaska, which is commonly referred to in the industry as district manager. I have worked and lived in Alaska since 1991 and do currently reside in Chugach within the boundaries of House District 3. I'm testifying today in support of HB 226. At Fred Meyer, we're deeply invested in the well-being of our patients, and we believe the bill represents a crucial step towards safeguarding patient rights and improving access to quality health care. Some of the major reforms include it ensures that patients have the freedom to choose their pharmacy without undue influence from pharmacy benefit managers, thereby empowering individuals to make informed decisions about their health care providers. Further, the bill would bring PBMs within the purview of the Alaska Unfair Trade Practices and Consumer Protection Act, which will promote fairness and transparency in the pharmacy industry. HB 226 will require reimbursement at an objective and transparent standard. PBM practices that reimburse pharmacies below a drug acquisitions cost have led to permanent and or temporary pharmacy closures within the state of Alaska, with rural areas being hit particularly hard. For those pharmacies that have not yet had to close their doors for either a few hours, days, or even permanently, they have not yet had to make some incredibly difficult decisions such as continuing to stock certain drugs, how to remain open, and are sustaining the current level of staffing without having to make staffing cuts, which results in lost jobs and or wages, which are impacting Alaskan employees, not being able to renew certain third-party contracts due to too low reimbursements. There really is no alternative when pharmacies are having to absorb significant and heavy losses. This bill will help ensure pharmacies continue to provide Alaskans the same level of service and access to the medication services they rely on. In short, HB 226 represents a major opportunity to advance patient rights, improve healthcare outcomes, and promote fairness in the pharmacy industry. We strongly support this legislation, and we encourage all members of the Alaska House.
Is Brittany Carnes. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brittany Carnes. I'm a born and raised Fairbankson, as are my aunts and uncles, my siblings, my nieces and nephews. My family's all in Interior Alaska, and we're going to stay here. I've worked at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital Pharmacy, Denali Pharmacy, and Chief Andrew Isaac Health Center Pharmacy, so across the spectrum of inpatient, local independent, and Indian Health Service. All of those are being directly impacted by bad PBM practices, and I'm calling to state that I'm extremely in support of House Bill 226. I had a lot of things written that have really already been said by other people today, so I guess the bottom line is these are big, big businesses that are making big, big money off of unfair practices. And what we're really asking for is for fair practices. You're hearing all the actual local pharmacies tell you that they are being choked out by big businesses who want all of that money. Why have white and brown bagging practices when all of these clinics and hospitals already have pharmacies with PharmD, you know, doctor pharmacies, who pharmacists who've done residencies? The only reason is so that you can make the money on the drug and then other people do all the work. Why do this thing where you mail insulin and inhalers with no counseling? It's because then those people come to my pharmacy and ask me how to do it, and I don't make any money off it, but I do it because they're my actual neighbor and my actual friend. So the bottom line is they have created a huge model that absolutely 100% is opaque, it is not transparent, and it drives the money out of state and to them, making them top 10 Fortune 500 companies, while all of your actual residents and your actual constituents who actually live here are telling you that it is killing our businesses and driving pharmacy out of Alaska. So please hear us. Please move this out of committee today. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Daniel Essam. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Daniel Eason, please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Okay, next is Karen Miller. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Karen Miller. I'm from Fairbanks, and I'm a pharmacist who currently works at Finale Pharmacy and Fairbanks Memorial Hospital for close to 30 years. Thanks for letting me call and passionately in support of House Bill 226. What I'm very, very concerned about is access to pharmacy care. In the last 2 years, we've seen the independent pharmacies close their doors or decrease their hours. I can speak to that. My pharmacy, Denali Pharmacy, is supported by a facility, but we had to change our hours from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. to now we're only open 9 to 6 because we just couldn't afford those extra hours. I'm really, really, truly concerned about the practices of the PBMs. All I'm asking for is transparency. My big questions like how and where is the savings going? They can constantly say they save healthcare dollars. I really believe that their savings in healthcare dollars turn into a burden of cost to providers, pharmacies, and patients. I've talked to multiple providers in the halls of the hospital that say, do I really need to call on that prior authorization? I have more patients to see than to deal with this. They actually are having to hire more staff, one FTE for every five providers, just to deal with the PBM practices to get paid claims. Or they're contracting with third-party vendors for thousands of dollars a year just to figure out what medication is currently covered by this pharmacy benefit plan. I won't go into the where the pharmacies are suffering. I think you've heard plenty of it. But basically, I can say we're not getting reimbursed for the cost of the drug, let alone a dispensing fee. But where I'm really, really concerned is that the cost, the burden of cost, is getting transferred to patients. Patients are paying bigger co-pays than ever before. Just last week, I had a patient who had to be discharged from the hospital for DKA because they could not afford to pick up their insulin. And so they went without it and ended up in the ICU. Where is the cost savings to that?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to try Daniel Essam again. Daniel Essam, put your name on the record and begin your testimony. No? Okay. Okay, that's everybody online. We'll come back to the room here one last time. Is there anybody wishing to testify on this bill? No? We will close public testimony. We are going to set an amendment deadline for this for Friday, March 29th at 4 p.m. Please get any amendments to my aide before the deadline. That concludes our business today. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 5:23 p.m.